Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Larimer. Today, joined by Mr. Michael Morris. Michael, how are you doing?
I'm very well, thank you, and nice to see you, Chris. I haven't seen you in the show for at least a year, I think. So good to see you both, of course.
Yes, no, good to have you both on at the same time. We also have, of course, Chris Hutton. Chris, how are you doing?
No, doing well, thank you. Yes, I've got so much white in my beard at this point. I'm just getting it colored now. So that's how long ago I was on the show with Michael. It has almost been a year.
Excellent stuff. Well, let's get into the most important news in South Africa over the last couple of the days. And that is the question of how the government's national unity is doing, specifically with regards to two pieces of very damaging legislation, particularly the NHI. We'll get to that in a second, though. But last week, we saw this sort of dramatic, sudden explosion of concern about whether the GNU was going to survive, because the president sort of announced, without really informing everyone ahead of time, that he was about to sign into law the Education Amendment Act, or the Bella Bill. And this was something that the DA, and I think also to a certain degree the Freedom Front Plus, had basically said they were opposed to very strongly, and that the DA says that during its negotiations with the ANC agreed that it would sort of send this back to Parliament for some reconsideration and some adjustments. Well, it looked for a moment as though the two parties might fall out and maybe the GNU might be headed for some damage. But at the very last minute, as Ramaphosa signed the thing into law, he did also say that the two most contentious parts of the act he would not sign into law. And we've gotten a little bit more details about this over the weekend. There's reporting in Report and also in City Press that basically John Steenhuisen from the DA said that Ramaphosa must talk to the leaders of AfriForum and Solidarity before ratifying the Bella Bill. So Dirk Herman and Kali Creel from Solidarity and AfriForum apparently, through a number of late-night calls, managed to convince him that these things needed to at least be have a bit of a rethink about them. They also lobbied the Freedom Front Plus and the DA from behind the scenes. And so sort of these groups working together managed to pressure Ramaphosa into, at the very least, kicking the can down the road and saying, okay, well, we won't implement the most contentious parts. We'll consider these things down the line. So there's now 3 months, apparently, in which they have to consider these things. At the same time, Ramaphosa is also talking about how he is open to meeting more on NHI to implement, to see what parts of it need to be implemented when. So he hasn't said that he's not going to push forward the National Health Insurance Scheme, but he has said that he's willing to, you know, give this a second look. And now this may just be politicking, but when you kind of read it in conjunction with the other story, I think it's quite interesting. So he took quite a sort of a tough sounding line. He said that he was looking for solutions, not more problems, with the NHI Act, which was already law. And, you know, we just want to work out some of the kinks in the situation and the implementation. We don't want to rewrite the whole law. But he did also offer some of his only criticism of Health Minister Aaron Motsoaledi, I think confirming some of what we suspected might be happening, which is that there is a division within the ANC over this. His criticism of the health minister was very gentle, but it was as follows. He said, quote, "I had a long discussion with the Minister of Health and said to him, we must never say to South Africans that we will not meet you or that there are things that cannot be discussed. Anything can be discussed because it is in discussing matters that you can find a solution. So yes, the NHI will be discussed with business this coming week, and we will see what proposals are put forward. I'm going to say, don't bring me problems, bring me solutions. What are the political costs going to be? What is the economic cost? What is the social cost?" So there are some proposals kicking around for how to reduce NHI. Now, I think NHI in many ways is much harder to fix than the Bella Bill. I think the whole thing should be scrapped, but there definitely are things that we can do in the sort of meantime to sort of reduce the negative impacts this would have on South Africa. Also today, President Ramaphosa, in response to a lot of this stuff, put out, he has this sort of weekly newsletter, and it's often quite dull, but this one I thought was worth quoting from a little bit. He said, "Dear fellow South Africans, on Wednesday last week, the leaders of the parties that form the Government of National Unity met to reflect on how the GNU is working." He went on to say, As party leaders, we nevertheless recognize that the parties in the GNU represent a range of political and ideological perspectives. There are issues on which we agree, and there will often be times when differences between parties become more apparent. A case in point has been the debate around the Bella Bill, which I signed last week. The Constitution is quite clear on the responsibilities of the President with respect to signing legislation. Once a bill has been passed by Parliament, the President must either assent to the bill or, if they have reservations about its constitutionality, refer it back to Parliament. Since after considering all the various submissions, I had no such reservations about the Bella Bill, the Constitution obliged me to assent to it. However, even as I signed the bill, I noted that some of the other parties in the GNU say they wanted to engage each other on parts of the bill dealing with issues of school admissions and language to give parties time to discuss these issues. I said we would delay implementation of the Act in order for parties to engage and come up with proposals, if any, on relevant clauses. In taking this approach, we are establishing a culture of openness and dialogue amongst the GNU parties. We are also drawing on a long history in South Africa of engagement among parties on matters in which they seem far apart. So, very long intro from me, but Michael, let me start with you. You recently wrote on the Bella Bill itself and how it's just sort of a bit silly because it misses the mark. But firstly, just can you tell us a little bit about what you said in your column? And secondly, is this a sign that the GNU may actually be making some sort of difference on the policy environment in South Africa? What do you think?
I think the potential certainly is there. I must say, when I saw you, when you shared the headline, we shared the link to the story about Cyril Ramaphosa's newsletter talking about how he responded to the Bella Bill and the emergence of opposition and his willingness to make it a point of discussion. And the headline, it didn't mention Cyril Ramaphosa, the headline said, Bella Bill engagement shows that GNU will not only survive but thrive. And you shared that, and I thought, oh, thank heavens, there's some other commentator who kind of more or less agrees with me, given the headline on my piece, which I'll get to in a minute. And then I was slightly worried when I opened it and saw it was actually Cyril Ramaphosa saying this. But anyway, I'll get to that in a moment. My piece this morning in Business Day, well, certainly in Business Live, the Business Day print edition headlines are a bit different, but the Business Live headline says GNU dynamics prove decisive over education bill. And essentially what I was driving at there was, and I given that I was writing this column on Friday, watching the news very closely, I didn't really know to begin with how certain I could be of my hunch that the GNU dynamics would in fact prove to be very influential. This indications up to then had been that John Steenhuisen had said very clearly, if this goes through, it's potentially a crisis. It could even risk the future of the GNU. And you then had reporting on Cyril Ramaphosa said, I'm not interested. I'm completely unmoved, I think was his phrasing. I'm going to sign this bill. I have no problem with it. And then by Friday morning, we could see already that there was some kind of softening of the positions on both sides. And it was only much later later on Friday when he was you know, announcing that he was signing the bill, when he was actually signing it, that Ramaphosa made it clear that he was going to make an exception for, or not really. I mean, it's very unclear actually what exactly this is going to mean. He's signed the bill, and he said there's no constitution.
Yeah, it's the quintessential kicking the can down the road.
Yeah. So you know, it's not as if the bill has been suspended. He signed the bill, but he's given 3 months for discussion around these two clauses. So that's going to be watched very closely. I still happen to think it is a significant indication of the kind of dynamics that we're dealing with. I think in our pre-show discussion, we all agreed that, you know, you would never have seen this kind of thing happening under the ANC before now for 30 years, over the past 30 years. And you certainly wouldn't have seen it had the ANC gone into coalition or into some kind of co-government or government of national unity with the EFF and MK. So it is significant. I think just two things that I'd like to add to that, one or three things maybe. The first is that although the kind of emphasis of the difference of opinion on those two clauses, parental and school governing body, essentially parental influence over the admissions policies and the language policies of schools, although it presents as essentially a problem for the Afrikaans-speaking community, because that's the community which has a particular interest in preserving the schools that they have, and the quality of the education, which necessarily means mother tongue education. The point to make is that a lot of our research and research elsewhere has shown that a key element of a successful educational system is one in which parents are directly involved, are directly invested. And to the extent that this or those clauses undermine that essential principle, it's not merely a problem for the Afrikaans speaking community. That's the one thing. And I think the other thing is, 3 months, everybody's going to be watching the government very closely. If it's merely going through the motions and pretending to be considering these serious points, it's not going to look very good, and a lot of political capital will be made of that. So I don't think they're really going to be able to get away with fobbing off the very valid reservations that have been raised. And the same will apply and has applied to the NHI. And I think the NHI, as you say, is possibly a much more serious thing. And very significant, I think, and I do agree with you that he's publicly said what he publicly described his discussion with the health minister in saying, we are going to discuss this. Don't tell me that we're not going to discuss it. We are going to discuss it. This is how we do things, and I think that is very, very significant. So between the two things, I think the better bill, it appears to be a kind of minority issue, but in fact it's central to education. It's also in a way a bit of a distraction from the real other big problems in education. But perhaps that's another. That's partly what I've spoken about in the piece. But the real key thing is now the dynamics of the discussions going forward. And NHI, I mean, these are two very big pieces of legislation which have been controversial. So a really key test, I think, for the GNU. Yeah.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think there's a point sort of worth being made here is you might say, if you're very cynical, you might look at this and say, there's no real concession here. Ramaphosa is just kicking cans down the road. He's just trying to sort of like give everyone some fodder and then kind of just go along as planned. And, I think there are two things to be said about that. The first one is we don't actually know that for sure yet. After 3 months, I think we're going to get an interview, a better insight on that. And also we're going to see if any changes are made to NHI or whether they do this sort of thing where they sort of say they're going to implement it and then just don't fund it and just sort of shuffle it into a corner. And then in 3 years, no one is talking about it anymore, which is a thing government has done before. It's a very good way of pretending like, here's a great example of where the government did it. They agreed to a youth wage subsidy. Younger workers would be, companies would be incentivized to essentially pay to hire young people and would get a subsidy from the government that was budgeted for in the national budget. And then COSATU opposed it. So the government sort of just kind of mumbled into their socks and then the policy just disappeared. But I think even if you are very cynical about whether the president really means that he's interested in compromising here, I think it is interesting that he feels like he needs to signal that he is going to compromise and that he does worry that the GNU might fall apart. And he wouldn't be making these sort of signals. He'd just bulldoze ahead if he thought that he had all the cards in his deck, so to speak. Chris, do you agree with me? And what do you make of this?
So at the moment, I think the most probable outcome, given what has come before in the context of how the ANC likes to operate, and especially Cyril, is that you push until there's some element of resistance and then you pull back. And you try and find other ways to still implement what you ultimately want to achieve. So I'm very open and hopeful to the possibility that this does signal a new sort of era for consultation and changes to legislation that in its utmost form is quite destructive, but I still worry just about what other things are at play here. And possibly something also to consider is how the Bella Bill is, if you were going to think of legislation or policy that embodies the person that is Panyaza Lesufi, the Premier of Gauteng, it is the Bella Bill. What does that say still about the influence that he retains within the broader ANC? You talk about factionalism and influence going up to the next ANC elective conference. Lesufi was, you know, pretty much on top of Ramaphosa at the signing ceremony. I might be reading too much into the sort of symbolism, but that sort of thing is also at play for Ramaphosa and others in the NEC to assuage interest groups, players within the broader ANC, the broader alliance, and keep it all together. And what you're willing to give in terms of just keeping the sort of unity idea going forward. We're not yet sure, of course, who's going to contest the next elective conference, but I think you'd put at least some money on someone like Lesufi. So that's also something to keep in mind. And then just the last point on the DA and the maybe some of the risks here. So in his address last week at the Cape Town Press Club, you know, Steenhuisen did highlight that the DA will not crash the government unless the government is crashing the economy or trashing the constitution. Now, that could be done by something like the NHI overnight, or it could be done incrementally. So where does the DA draw the line? If you say, this is a line, we're not going to compromise on this, we're going to walk away, can you then satisfy your constituency, different constituencies, and potential voters that this isn't you sort of not keeping to that line in the sand, as it were, that you're actually adhering to it and you're going to follow through with your requirements and your concessions that you demand from your GNU partner. So lots at play here. I fully take on board it could be a different time for policy formation and legislation formation in South Africa, but I do just worry still about the balance of forces broadly leaning towards and in favor of the ANC.
I think that's a very valid concern. But I do think that if in a year from now we're looking back at an NHI that has at least been postponed, if not gutted, and a Bella Bill that has been significantly watered down. These are, you know, this is not enough to get South Africa working. This is just heading off new problems coming down the tracks. But I think the GNU will have proved at least some value to the country if those two objectives can be accomplished. Now, you know, are we going to get 5% economic growth as a result of this? No, not at all. Are we going to see this huge unemployment rate reduction? Not at all. Are we going to see our education system spring to life? Not at all. But stopping these things, if you don't stop these pieces of legislation, you can't even begin to think about, you know, reaching those lofty heights. Michael, final thoughts?
I mean, just your last point and indeed Chris's too, but it just made me think of the very first line of my piece where I say that in a society justifiably obsessed with granting power to the people, it's remarkable how often scant attention is paid to what people actually want. And, you know, on all these issues, education, healthcare, the economy, jobs, and so on, the primary demand is better education, better healthcare, more jobs, economic growth. We want people to work together. We want merit. We don't want, you know, this reliance on old-fashioned kind of race-based thinking or blaming colonialism or blaming apartheid. We want to just move ahead. We want to achieve all these things. And as we spoke, I think last week we spoke about the data and statistics on medical aids in South Africa, that the higher percentage, 51.7%, I think it was, of medical aid members in South Africa are actually Black African. And it's a minority, 31.7, I think it was, or 37.1, whichever, certainly in the 30s, are you know, supposedly wealthy white people. So the society itself has moved on. And I think, the greater potential now is that the ANC will be made aware of this constantly and increasingly. And that, I think, has the greater potential to shift it. Because it must realize that is the future of the country. Urbanized, massively urbanizing quickly, you know, and rapidly still urbanizing. I used some figures a couple of weeks ago. At the moment, we're 67% urbanized. I think the UN Habitat estimates that by 2050, we're going to be 80% urbanized. So we, you know, a fast urbanizing society, sophistication is growing, education is growing, people want better things. They don't want to be treated as if they're peasants living in the 1940s. And they want their policy environment to be modern, dynamic, you know, and delivering what they want. Yeah,
exactly. No, the ANC still's very much got its head in 1940s policy and politics. In fact, we're lucky 1940s policy and politics. Sometimes we go back to the 1890s.
Well, but anyway, trying to think of a date. Yeah, yeah, exactly.
All right, let us go on to our next topic. And this is a sort of looming legal battle in over a plan to sort of fix our ports. Now, Chris, maybe you can give me some insights into whether you think these plans have the potential to actually address some of the problems with our ports. One of the big issues, particularly our mining sector has had over the past couple of years, is that every time they try to export coal, either the railway track or, you know, whatever minerals they're selling, gold, whatever, either the train tracks are broken, unsafe, not running properly, or the ports are dysfunctional. South Africa's Durban port is ranked below other ports, even in Africa, such as Maputo. Now, anyone who's been to Mozambique will know that Mozambique is not a well-run country, and yet their port system manages to outperform us pretty consistently, which is, to say the least, rather depressing. Anyway, so there was this plan that's been kicked around by government now that it was going to do this deal with, I think, a Filipino company to privatize essentially Container Port 2 in Durban, Container Terminal Pier 2, rather, and that this would help to alleviate some of the problems with the port in Durban. However, the company which came second in the bidding process, which is a Danish company, has decided to take government to court over this. They say that there were irregularities in the awarding of the tender, and that it needed to reconsider the tender process and perhaps, you know, consider whether they, in fact, would have been the best company to get this deal. They highlighted a number of issues to do with financial capacity and concerns raised by various auditors about the winning company. The government is hit back by saying that this was a national priority. The plan and its finalization was very urgent, and we needed to move forward immediately with this deal, or else the country's economic future could be put at risk. So my initial thoughts on seeing this, and without just sort of going through all of the court documents and everything, is just that, I mean, I don't think it's implausible that there was irregularity in the awarding of contracts. But I'm not sure if we're going to get much of a better deal. I don't know, Chris. What's your take on this whole thing?
No, I think it's quite rational that the burden of proof rests on the government and Transnet in terms of the awarding of these contracts, tenders, et cetera, given the history of the performance of South Africa's state-owned entities over the last 5 to 10 years, especially where you talk about inserting non-value-adding intermediaries. That has almost been the mantra or the code that they live by day to day, of course, for preferencing political contacts, influence, et cetera, et cetera. So at the moment, I would more lean towards that side. On the other hand, you have, you know, the government, for example, and Transnet saying that APM, which is trying to interdict this decision, is doing it purely to protect its, quote, narrow commercial interest, end quote, as though the company based in the Philippines doesn't also have a commercial interest. And it's a 25-year concession that they would be invested in. And I'm assuming that they would also from their side want some sort of, maybe not a massive profit, but they would also want to get something out of it. They're not doing this for purely altruistic reasons. So some of the things that APM has alleged and highlighted, you have questions around whether this company based in the Philippines complied with mandatory requirements relating to financial capacity. And when this was flagged by auditors, Transnet, instead of disqualifying the company, gave it numerous opportunities to correct the non-compliance. So you know, maybe shifting the goalposts, an element of that, trying to just make sure that this gets done. And then you've got the, I guess, the pressure of, yes, you need to get the ports and the railways to function. So it's in the national interest to get these things going. You can't, you know, dilly-dally, maybe worrying about dotting all the I's and crossing all the T's. So when you go through it, and given again the context in which Transnet and the Transnet Ports Authority, other SOEs have found themselves, that is where one leans. We'll need to see now in the next 2 to 3 days as the court case proceeds what particular other details and findings do come out of it. But, you know, the big obviously takeaway here is, even though there is maybe pragmatic concessions on the part of government that we need to change how the SOEs function, especially our ports, you need private sector investment, skills, etc., there's still a long way to go.
Michael, what do you make of this case? You know, I think what's interesting here is, you know, I'm in general in favor of a privatization as a sort of basic principle thing. But of course, I think it can also be done badly. And, you know, when you have a government that's sort of so riven by rent seeking and bad ideology and all these sort of things, the potential for kind of bad deals to be done, even when you're kind of moving in the right direction, which is away from these sort of central control, I think is very evident. So I remain a little bit skeptical about some of these efforts to privatize rail and ports, even though it's probably what I would do, at least in broad strokes, if I was in charge of this process. I don't know. What do you make of this?
Yeah, I certainly agree. I mean, I often think of, you know, the corporate world as being just as human as the state world. So to me, they're not necessary, or, you know, great discrepancies between the relative strengths of the two. The phrase that comes to mind here is just as our colleague Terence's favorite, which is, there are many moving parts here. And I think this is certainly true. It's a complex story. One of the virtues, of course, is that it is very open. You know, none of these institutions or companies and entities are really able to function without the courts having a, you know, a beady eye on them. The public is being fully appraised of things. So we are in fortunate in that sense. We really are quite an open country. And you know, if there are things going wrong, they're going to come out. So and this is a good thing. I think all the people involved in these kinds of negotiations, sorting out and meeting the very onerous requirements of national interest, which is, you know, we've heard this before for decades really in this country, they do need to be accountable. They do need to make sure their noses are clean, and if they're not, there are going to be consequences. So yeah, a very tricky one, and we'll have to see how what the courts find. It's not implausible. I mean, this is the tragedy in a way of our condition, that we always assume and are so often proved right that there has been malfeasance or fraud, corruption, and so on. That's just the condition in which these problems are going to have to be confronted in. You know, that suspicion is going to be there. You just see the comments from people listening to the show. You know, there is a widespread public distrust in public institutions, and this has got to be overcome if we're really going to get ahead.
Well, I just hope that the courts hearing these things do so efficiently, because the worst thing to add to the situation would be 14,000 court delays until, you know, this deal just dies in the back room of some office somewhere. Anyway. Okay, let's go on to our last story very briefly. And this is a kind of quite horrifying one, but once again highlighting the huge problems in local government we have. So the West Rand of Gauteng, the area around Krugersdorp, is the municipality of Mogale City. And this is supposed to be a bit of a tourism hotspot for Gauteng. It has the very interesting museum, the Cradle of Humankind, and the sort of tourism activities around there. It also has some farming and other aspects like that, but it's not going as well as it should. Why? Well, because apparently for the last 2 years, the municipality's sewage treatment plants have not been working. And as a result, the municipality has simply been dumping all of the sewage into local rivers, which are ending up in the Vaal Crocodile River and, of course, Hartbeespoort Dam. This has been going on for 2 years, they've been dumping tens of thousands of liters of raw sewage into the area's rivers every day. Where the river is not accessible, the municipality simply dug a large open pit in a residential area to dump raw sewage right next to the N14 highway. Water in the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site has also been badly polluted, which has damaged tourism in the area. The problems are at the Peter Stewart Water Treatment Works, as well as the pump stations in Brickville and Musenville. So I think it was News 24 did this report. They contacted the city manager or the municipal manager of Mogale City to ask, you know, how long have these things been broken for? Why are they broken? And what are you doing to fix them? And was promised answers multiple times, but none were forthcoming. Chris, your thoughts?
Yeah, sort of. What's that accusation leading the witness in some of your how you phrase that? So,
To be fair, it's a bit of a shitty situation.
Given all the focus on electricity and drinking water and the infrastructure challenges, maybe there is a serious lack of focus on wastewater management and just how much of a task that takes. So we talk about elements of quote-unquote privatization, state-proofing yourself, but I think there are big concerns and that they haven't really been alleviated or, to my satisfaction, been addressed in terms of maybe dealing with that sort of service delivery on a metro-wide scale, never mind a small municipality. And when the state or the government fails in that function, the implications not just for businesses in terms of, you know, their employees, but also basic hygiene for households, etc., for people who have never enjoyed that sort of level of service in any case. So it's indicative, I think, again, of the lack of focus on details of governance and municipal management day to day. It's not particularly sexy, might not win awards and things like that. You're not going to make a whole presidential speech about it. But without those things functioning, you can say goodbye to all of your 3%, 5% growth rates, all that sort of stuff. This is very difficult work that takes a long time to either build up and to maintain, or then to fix again once it's fallen apart. And you shouldn't presume that it can be fixed again.
Any final thoughts from you, Michael?
Definitely agree with that. It's not a sexy problem, and the part of the issue here is that it might not necessarily be visible. So, but very good then that News 24 and hopefully other media are going to follow up on this, that they do bring home the point that looking at the piece here, it's been more than a month since News 24 asked the municipality during the first week of August why the sewage treatment plant and pump stations weren't working. Inquiries over whether there was a plan to get any of these systems back to working order have gone unanswered by the municipality. So, you know, keeping attention on these people, I guess at the municipal level, there isn't quite the same sense of precariousness that the ruling party might be feeling at the national level, having just come through a national election. But I feel pretty sure that if people begin to realize that they really are agents of their political destiny, that come the next local government elections, these sorts of things will become increasingly prominent and pressing in people's minds. And let's hope, you know, they'll force a change. But it's really the only way in a free open society like our one. You've just got to use whatever agency you have to get the results you want. And South Africans are learning that.
Yeah, the ANC only got about 37-38% or so in Mogale City in the national election. So I think the potential in 2 years for the balance of power to shift in that city is, I think, quite real. If they want to stay in power, they could have fixed the sewage treatment plant.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's all the time we have for today. We hope that you found the show interesting, and we will be back tomorrow on the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone.